Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 17, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. This sutta, the Buddha teaches the Four Noble Truths for the first time. What is most important is to remember that everything the Buddha would teach for his entire 45-year teaching career was taught in the context of Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. I know I've taught this in quite a few ways, and it's in the books in a good rendition of it, but I've never taught specifically to the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, which was surprising to me when one of my students pointed it out. This is what the Buddha taught. He spent his whole entire career teaching in the context of Four Noble Truths and dependent origination. And when you understand this now, you all have the perspective to see this as a complete teaching. It's quite obvious. And how brilliant this is. Anyway. For a few weeks after his awakening, Siddhartha carefully considered if it was possible to teach to others his profound understanding of the nature of suffering that arises due to wrong views of self within this impermanent environment. So you understand that. It's all relating to the three marks of existence. Developing the wisdom of a Buddha is developing insight into these three marks of existence. As described in the Paticca-Samuppada Sutta, the primary sutta on dependent origination, the conditions that dukkha is dependent on arise from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And there's many, many suttas where the Buddha refers to this process beginning in ignorance and ending in suffering. And sometimes, depending on the situation, there might only be nine links, but there's really no significance to that except it's situational and how the Buddha's teaching it. As shown and taught in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Eightfold Path is the middle way that avoids extreme views that would continue wrong views rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths described in the sutta. So last week, David brought up an important point. He had heard about the idea of counting during meditation, and that's often presented for beginners if you're having difficulty quieting your mind, but even later on, that counting or some other substitute for breath meditation, and it's often presented that it's appropriate, that it's meditation, that it's mindfulness, etc., etc., etc. And I guess it is all of those things. You can call just about anything meditation if it gets you to focus on something, even something that's really not meditation, like walking or chanting or bowing, rituals. They're not really meditation in any sense. And then often contemplative practices are taught as meditation. In other words, bring a topic and quiet your mind and consider that one topic. And again, that's useful at times, but it's not meditation. And so anytime that we find ourselves substituting something for the simple meditation method that the Buddha taught, it's always in relation to the hindrances that we talked about last week. And specifically, there are workarounds from having to deal with a hindrance. So the example last week of counting is just a perfect example of that. And as we went around the room, it kind of got to this point that even past the beginning stage in meditation, if you've used substitutes such as counting, it'll often become part of your conditioned thinking and just always be there. And so when you're having difficulty just focusing on what the Buddha taught, you might come up with counting again. You'll remember that, this was easy, I can count, and that'll help me have a useful meditation. So you start counting, but what you're doing when you're counting is avoiding the hindrance that's there in the first place, such as indifference, or David brought up restlessness. Those are two that often come up. Doubt is often something that will have a substitute, something for what the Buddha taught, simply because it allows us to maintain a level of comfortability while we're meditating. We're okay without dealing with our hindrances. So is that clear that we use these different methods and techniques to avoid dealing with what we should be dealing with? And so that's really the problem. I got you, Frank. That's really the problem with anything that we substitute for what the Buddha taught. The Buddha taught a very clear and direct and specific Dhamma that doesn't lend itself to embellishments or accommodations of any kind. It just doesn't. And every time we substitute something, it's an accommodation against what the Buddha actually taught every single time, which is hard to see unless you're really looking for it. But you can take that all the way back to the Second Buddhist Council, where they started substituting things that were more appealing to their vision of what a Dharma practice should be rather than what the Buddha taught. And that's always the problem. So that's there's really no reason to substitute anything that the Buddha taught. He taught a complete practice, an Eightfold Path, and he taught a very specific meditation method that was part of that Eightfold Path. And so the reason why I mentioned indifference is any time that we've given ourselves license to substitute something that an awakened human being taught, it's obvious that it's just for that reason, to avoid something else that is important in the teaching. Again, that's why the Buddha taught that very specific teaching. Frank.
What's the name of the teaching where the Buddha taught how to meditate?
There's quite a few. The most important ones are the Satipatthana Sutta, the four
mindfulness. I'm talking about where he says focus on your breath. Like where does he say what part of your breath to focus on?
It begins in that sutta where he says to become mindful of the breath in the body. That's the establishment of meditation also.
So there's not one just specifically on meditation.
Yes, that and the Anapanasati Sutta. And then the suttas where he teaches the purpose, such as the Samadhi Sutta or the Yoganatha Sutta, where again he refers to being mindful of the breath. So in every situation, his teaching of breath meditation refers to both of those suttas that begin with be mindful of your breath in your body.
So he doesn't say where to be mindful of the breath.
Yes, in the beginning of meditation. But then, obviously, as he goes through that whole sutta, he then teaches us to take that meditation that's rooted in mindfulness of the breath in the body off our cushions and teaches us how to do that. Finally, teaching that we hold in mind the refined mindfulness of the entire Eightfold Path off our cushion. Yeah. So it sounds like I'm talking around you, but I'm not. But I'm pointing you right back to his initial instruction on meditation. Be mindful of the breath in the body. Then he teaches to be mindful of feelings arising and passing away in a dispassionate way. Then to be mindful of thoughts arising and passing away, the third foundation of mindfulness. And then finally, that fourth foundation of mindfulness, to be mindful of the present quality of mind, which I give at the end of the meditation.
So when I start my meditation, I'm mindful of the breath through my nose. So he doesn't say where to be mindful of the breath.
Oh, no. Not. I don't think he ever referred to it through the nose. Be mindful of the breath in the body. You know, he might, but I don't remember.
Sometimes that expression, you bring mindfulness to the four.
Well, that's the four foundations of mindfulness, which means bringing mindfulness to the four means that whatever you are doing in the present moment, whether it's washing your car or being mindful of your breath, mindfulness should be at the four. I mean, it should be the guiding quality of our mind. So again, he's using breath meditation to begin to establish the four foundations of mindfulness, so that once they're established in meditation, they are now established everywhere in our lives off our cushion. So again, we might even want a more elaborate meditation teaching or maybe more of a formal focus on it because it's so important. But I think the Buddha gave that indistinction for a reason, it's one of the most important aspects of an Eightfold Path, but it's not the only aspect. And the method itself is as simple as mindful of the breath in the body.
I think that the point that I'm trying to make with myself is that I'm starting to become aware in my meditation where I'm too mindful of the breath entering through my nose and not more on the quality of breath or the fact that I'm breathing, like understanding that I'm breathing.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And it's just enough to be mindful of your breathing. The depth of the breath or the kind of breath that it is, and none of that is really important. And the Buddha never teaches it. And those are all embellishments after his teachings too. However you find yourself breathing, be mindful of the breath in the body. And the reason why that's important is if you decide in your mind or somebody teaches you that your breath must be slow and shallow and steady to meditate, and people teach that, to first generate that. When you find that your breath isn't slow and steady and shallow, wait a minute, I can't meditate, my breath isn't correct. however you find yourself breathing is appropriate. You're only using the breath as a tool of focus. If it's fast, if it's shallow, if it's jittery, if it's hard to find, it doesn't matter. Be mindful of the breath in the body. And then at any meditation session, that's the appropriate breath for you. So again, we should avoid trying to get even more analytical than just that, the breath in the body.
I mean, isn't the natural action of breathing also bringing you to the natural law of impermanence?
Oh yeah, I mean that's the real point of using the breath, because it is, every breath is an impermanent breath, and as we become mindful of it, become mindful of the in-breath and the out-breath, we're mindful of the whole cycle of phenomena coming into our life and passing out of our life in that breath, and that's really the important thing. And a visualization or a counting or anything else can't do that. It can't bring that immediate experience of impermanence, which again is the whole point of the Buddha's teaching. Thank you, Dave. Okay, let me get into the sutta or I'll never get through it. It is the self-identification with ongoing suffering, or meaning clinging or joining with suffering, that obscures impermanence through the continuation of self-referential unsatisfactory experiences. Again, substituting anything for meditation is substituting the ongoing unsatisfactory experience of dukkha, excuse me, for awakening. The Buddha taught an eightfold path to develop the concentration, supporting the refined mindfulness necessary to integrate the eightfold path as the framework for recognizing and abandoning all wrong views rooted in ignorance. Long, long sentence that simply means we need the concentration developed in a very specific meditation practice to support the refined mindfulness to hold in mind each factor of the Eightfold Path. And again, that describes the whole Dhamma. If we can do that, and we can, we will develop the wisdom of a Buddha. How do we know that? Because he did it, and he's showing us the way to do it. The entire 45-year teaching career of the Buddha was taught in the context of dependent origination and Four Noble Truths to bring wisdom, understanding, and profound insight into these three marks of existence. This very first teaching was presented to the five ascetics he had previously befriended, all seeking understanding. Again, this is about 2 weeks after his awakening. The Buddha, on one occasion, the Buddha was, let me read it as it says in the sutta, because then this is Ananda recounting this. I have heard, whenever you hear, I have heard, that's Ananda. Thus I have heard that on this occasion the Buddha was staying at Varanasi and the game refuge at Isipatana. There he addressed the, this is right near where he awakened and still there today, near the Bodhi tree. There he addressed a group of five. There are these two extremes that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects. This behavior is base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable. It is devoted to self-affliction. We're doing it to ourselves. That which is devoted to self-affliction is always painful, always ignoble. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way is realized by the Tathagata. The Buddha referred to himself as the Tathagata, which means the one who has gone forth, which simply means the one who has left the world behind and developed an understanding of the Buddha. And he refers to himself that way to simply show that he's the guy that first figured it out, and everyone else can do exactly the same thing, except they'll never be the first. And that was the only reason the only difference he made between himself and other people. He never called himself a Buddha or an awakened one or anything like that. There was always, I'm the Tathagata, I figured it out, and in a very practical way, I figured it out so you can trust me, I'm telling you now. And so they did. This middle way leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding, which is exactly how we describe an awakened human being as someone who is unbound from clinging to ignorant views. One who has gone forth refers to one who has gained understanding framed by the Eightfold Path and no longer craves after or clings to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas of the world. They simply are taking life in a very impersonal, dispassionate way. The Buddha's words, and what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm, to self-awakening, to abiding? What is it? Is it chanting? Is it rituals? Is it memorization, visualization? Is it deity worship?
Quieting the mind.
Quieting the mind and developing the Eightfold Path. It's the only, the Buddha, when you read it this way, here's an awakened human being teaching others, I would say even being willing to teach others, going through the trouble. And he's saying, this is what it is. It's nothing else. The middle way is precisely this noble eightfold path. Begins with right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And then he says, this is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm, to self-awakening, and to unbinding. That's enough for me. I'm following that. I got to tell you, when I first read these words for probably the 100th time, but they had finally sunken in, that I realized literally what I've been looking for since the time I was born probably is right here in front of me. It was a revelation. There was some anger and frustration out of what I felt at the time was a waste of time up in, you know, until I came across this. But there was also, you know, great joy because I realized the simplicity and I kind of understood this is something I can do. It's not based on endless eons of rituals and chants and other devotional studies, which always left me a little bit on edge and a little bit in disbelief that an awakened human being would teach something like this rather than something entirely practical, which is what I had just found by reading the sutta. This is the middle way, realize the Tathagata that brings vision and direct knowledge that leads to calm, to self-awakening, and to unbinding. Unbinding refers to the culmination of the path, abandoning clinging to views rooted in ignorance of these four noble truths. The Buddha says, I teach the truth of suffering, dukkha, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering, nothing more. And this is, now you're back in that 2,600 years ago, this is the same words that the Buddha used, except he was using a Pali dialect at the time. Same thing. This is the noble truth of stress. Birth is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are all stressful. Furthermore, association with the unbeloved is stressful, and separation from what is loved is stressful. You could say that separation from the Dhamma is stressful. Because he's referring to the Dhamma, isn't he, here? Because ultimately it is separation from the truth that leads to stress. Not getting what is craved for is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. Now remember, he's teaching this to five of his friends who really don't have the background in this specific teaching, but they have a general background in what they were seeking. So they know what hasn't been working up until that point. I go into a little bit about the five clinging aggregates, but I won't get into that here. The five clinging aggregates simply describe the ongoing personal experience of suffering. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of stress. The craving that makes for further becoming, meaning rooted in ignorance, remember when I talked about dependent origination in that seventh or eighth link, where we become ignorant. That's the Buddha's referring to, becoming further ignorant. And accompanied by passion and delight in becoming further ignorant, relishing now here and now there, meaning everywhere we go, we're establishing ourselves in everything. Kind of living a really completely stressful, stress-filled existence of continually driven to establish self-referential views in every thought, word, and idea that occurs. And he's even describing the frenzy a little bit in doing that. Now here and now there. Everywhere we go, we're spending our entire life holding up this ego picture of ourselves that nobody else really cares about, except it's in our minds. And once we've created it, now we need everybody else to go along with it. Because don't we feel threatened when our view of self is threatened? It's because we know House of Cards. You know, there's nothing really propping it up. But even that brings fear. And I think it's the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha talks about once fear is established, he's basically saying all is lost because now you're consumed by that fear even if you don't realize it. That fear is the underlying stress of being found out, of not being able to maintain this self-referential ego self. Relishing now here and now there, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. relishing now here and now there is craving, by craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming, means compulsive seeking to establish a self rooted in ignorance in every thought, word, and idea. And this, monks, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress. The remainderless fading and cessation, the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, and letting go of that very craving. Again, how much more simple and direct can it get? In right intention, the Buddha states that it is wrong intention, the intention for craving and maintaining a self-referential ego self through wrong views and clinging to those wrong views that continues to establish suffering. So right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving. And it really gets to be that simple. It doesn't get to be that simple. It is that simple. There's nothing more to do but to recognize the effects of craving rooted in wrong views and how we've maintained those views through clinging to them once they're established. The first noble truth and the second noble truth. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of dukkha, of stress, precisely the noble eightfold path of right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. So we know what all those things are. There's nothing really confusing about the right or the skillful aspects of the eightfold path. What is left then is just to incorporate them into our lives. What else? Nothing. It's just that. But it's almost in its simplicity and its directness that we reject it, or we want to create more of it, including something as simple as David pointed out last week, of interjecting counting meditation or some other practice. And again, the Buddha's teaching this, remember, for the very first time to these five people who have never heard this before. And yet, wait till the end. The Buddha continues, vision arose. Insight arose, remember insight into the three marks of existence. Discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me. And this is so important. With regards to things never heard before. So the Mahayanists, one of the things that they wanted to interject at the second and third Buddhist council was this group called the Mahasanghikas, who wanted to establish what the Buddha had taught as, they wanted to establish the Buddha as one Buddha among many, stretching endlessly into the future and into the past. And they also wanted to establish the Buddha as a deity-like creature like other gods that they worshipped founded in the Vedas. And the established Sangha didn't want anything to do with this. They made some minor accommodations that now established them as Theravadins. And so the Mahasanghikas left that original Sangha to start a new form of Buddhism that was more visionary, more mystical, more inclusive of all of their ideas, including counting men, they didn't count men. Maybe they did. But all these embellishments now, because they had given license to the initial ones, were now okay. And now it was simply whatever group decided was part of Buddhism is now part of Buddhism. And that began immediately, it began during the Buddhist time, and then it took hold at the first Buddhist council and then was given root at the second Buddhist council. Let me read that again, too, just to set the context. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. Dukkha occurs, the first noble truth. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. The noble truth of stress is to be understood. Understanding the nature of stress, its arising and passing away, is the task associated with the first noble truth. Understanding that ignorance of the impermanence of all conditioned phenomena, including what constitutes a self, initiates craving and clinging. This initial ignorance then allows for clinging to wrong views of self, meaning mental fabrications, wrong views of self and attached to impermanent objects, events, views, and ideas. Is that clear? This unknowingly and mindlessly establishes disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences, dukkha, as personal experiences given an individual personality from this initial ignorance. Life experiences established in ignorance and can only lead to continuing confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences unless something comes along that allows us to recognize and abandon that ignorance. It is insight into a nature, impermanence, and anatta, the not-self characteristic, that brings wisdom and knowledge of things never heard before and results in awakening as the Buddha describes awakening. The Buddha's words, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before, such as the noble truth of stress has been understood. He's declaring to his five friends that he's figured it out. The Eightfold Path develops the skills of concentration and refined mindfulness necessary to support accomplishing the task associated with developing understanding of Four Noble Truths. Profound and penetrative understanding of the origination and cessation of stress of dukkha is awakening, the Buddha's words. Vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. He keeps stressing that point, that this is the first time that in human history these things have been in part of our understanding. This is the noble truth of the origination of stress. This noble truth of the origination of stress is to be abandoned. He's teaching us what to do with it. The noble truth of the origination of stress has been abandoned. We've developed a path. This refers to the second noble truth of recognizing and abandoning craving and clinging. The Buddha continues, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is the noble truth of the cessation of stress. The noble truth of the cessation of stress is to be directly experienced, ahipasika. This noble truth of the cessation of stress has been directly experienced. He's describing how he has developed the Eightfold Path. He has had the experience. Vision arose, I should probably say, and so, vision arose, insight arose, discernment arose, knowledge arose, illumination arose within me with regards to things never heard before. This is a noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress is to be developed, pointing to the Eightfold Path. This noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress has been developed. This last refers to the Four Noble Truths and the truths of the path, developing profound and penetrative insight into three marks of existence. The Eightfold Path provides simple and direct guidance of an awakened human being's Dhamma. The Buddha continues, monks, as long as my knowledge and vision concerning these Four Noble Truths was not pure, I did not claim to have directly self-awakened. My self-awakening is unexcelled in the cosmos, even with all its deities and Maras and Brahmas. Now he's making reference to what was common during his time and saying that my awakening is beyond or above all of these other things that you hold as so-called spiritual. It is unexcelled in the cosmos, even with the deities, the Maras, the Brahmins, with its contemplatives and Brahmins, its royalty, and its common folk. Here the Buddha is declaring that his Dhamma surpasses the spiritual practice of his time for all beings, regardless of their understanding of that or their social position. It was often taught during the Buddha's time, it's still common in parts of India, that unless you were of a certain class, any type of spiritual teaching wasn't allowed to you. If you were especially the undesirable class, you couldn't even listen to someone teaching something. Yeah. The Buddha continues, but as soon as my knowledge and vision concerning these Four Noble Truths was truly pure, then I did claim to have directly self-awakened, and I am an awakening unexcelled in the cosmos. Knowledge and vision arose in me, unprovoked is my release. Unprovoked is an interesting line. Remember, it's a translation from the Pali word. But what it means is that there's nothing left driving there's no remnant of his ignorance driving him anymore. It's unprovoked, it's pure. His knowledge and wisdom is now resting in pure Dhamma. There's no remnant of that ignorance left behind. Unprovoked is my release. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. There's so many myths that followed from not listening to what the Buddha, including the importance of developing awakening right here in this lifetime. The Buddha is declaring in his very first teaching that this is my last birth. I'm not coming around anymore. And yet most everybody that developed Buddhism in general since then takes to it like it's an eons and eons long process, because that's how it's taught. And yet the Buddha's very first teaching was, you can do it in this lifetime. I figured it out and I'm done. You can do the same. This is the last birth. There is now no further becoming. The Buddha is also declaring that there's nothing left in him that would allow for him to become further ignorant. There is now no further becoming. Unprovoked is my release, which refers to the emptiness of ignorance in the Buddha's mind. Having become empty of ignorance, there is no longer the condition present, meaning ignorance, to provoke craving, clinging, or any thought, word, or deed rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. This is the last birth, is the Buddha's declaration that the conditions giving rise to the birth of life experiences arising from ignorance of Four Noble Truths and resulting in dukkha no longer exist. We covered that in the last few weeks of our study. The most important teachings on rebirth is not creating the conditions for favorable rebirths. It's ending the conditions for birth completely in this lifetime. And even the thought of creating conditions for a favorable day tomorrow is contrary to the Dhamma. What's most important is to continue to cultivate a well-concentrated mind, holding the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path. And to that point, we shouldn't be concerned about anything else. Meaning that if we find that we're having a few unpleasant days, are we mindful of the Dhamma? Are we continuing to meditate and integrate the Eightfold Path? Fine, that's all we need to do. Don't become distracted by even the ever-changing quality of your life. It's important to notice the practical benefits that the Dhamma is bringing to you, but not to overemphasize it to the point that we're judging each moment in relation to the Dhamma. We can judge the quality of our mind in relation to the Dhamma. In other words, if our minds are disturbed in this present moment, to understand where that's coming from and come back into the refined mindfulness of the Dhamma. But it's never helpful to judge our Dhamma in a harsh way. We always be gentle with ourselves. It's a key to awakening. There is now no further becoming means that having emptied himself of ignorance, becoming further established in ignorance is abandoned, and becoming awakened, becoming a Buddha, is achieved. To conclude this is what the Buddha said. The group of five monks were delighted at his words. While this discourse was being given, Khandana declared, all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. What's Khandana speaking to there? All conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. Yeah. And so the Buddha, upon hearing that, said, so you really know, Khandana, so you really know, you are now Anakhandana, the one who understands. Khandana had penetrated the entire Four Noble Truths, listening to that. Now, understand, Khandana had been studying much as the Buddha had over the past 6 years, maybe even longer. So he was ready to hear it. And he also had, in their conversations over the years, I'm sure they discussed what they were looking for. So we had some of the context, and now the Buddha just gave him the entire context that he needed to finally declare all conditioned things that arise are subject to cessation. And he's speaking to impermanence, but then very specifically to his own conditioned mind. He understood at a very profound and penetrative level that the conditions that his mind rooted in ignorance developed in is impermanent. And because it's impermanent, he can let go of those views. All conditioned things that arise, including the thoughts attached to those, are subject to cessation. Poof, they're gone. And now what's left is an awakened human being. We've let go of all conditioned things. That's what the sutta points us to understand in a very profound way the three marks of existence, and this guides our insight. There's another, I don't want to get into it. Tired of doing that. Well, I can't. the Buddha teaches insight in very specific ways to the three marks of existence, and he's not so concerned about insight into other things. It's important to be mindful and be present with life as life occurs, but to gain insight into the dishes or anything else is not the insight that we're looking for and is often a distraction. It's important to be mindful of what we're doing, but don't overemphasize mundane tasks to the point that they're now a distraction. What's more important to be mindful of while we're doing the dishes is anything that might come up in our thinking in reference to the Eightfold Path while we're doing the dishes. That's much more important than how much soap is on our dishes. Where's my view right now? What's my intention? Where are the virtuous factors in my thinking? How is my right effort right now? Because doing the dishes is a good time to engage in right effort, isn't it? Because it doesn't take a lot of thought. You can be mindful of something else, like right speech or right action. So the importance of this very first sutta can't be overemphasized, but its simplicity is apparent, isn't it? And so we can rest, and it's skillful to do so. We can rest our entire Dhamma practice on this first teaching and our understanding, just briefly, of that it is from ignorance of these Four Noble Truths that leads to the suffering in our life. And that's an important reminder. We don't have to go through the entire dependent origination, although it doesn't hurt. But to remind ourselves in this moment, if I'm feeling stress at all, it's because of my own ignorance of the Four Noble Truths. I haven't developed it enough. And at that point, be gentle with yourself and just realize there's a little more study and integration to go. That's it. No reason to judge ourselves harshly. And just as the other four folks continue with the Buddha's Dhamma, those that have been on retreat will know that at the next discourse a couple weeks later, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Buddha teachings on the not-self characteristic, the other four folks got it at that point, and they understood. The reason why I'm saying that is very quickly in the Buddha's teaching career, he had people developing the Dhamma. What's happening here? It's remarkable how far we are going. And the third, we did this on retreat, we'll do it again. The third sutta was the Adatta Pariyaya Sutta, the sutta on the fire discourse of passions arising related to ignorance. So in those first three suttas, you can say that the Four Noble Truths, in a general way, speaks to impermanence. The Anattalakkhana Sutta, the Buddha's second sutta, teaches the not-self characteristic, the first two factors of the three marks. And the Aditya Pariyaya Sutta teaches about dukkha arising. So in the first three suttas, the Buddha addressed the three marks of existence. Again, establishing the foundation for everything that would follow. Those suttas even are given a little bit more credence than you would think they would, as they're often called the cardinal discourses of the Buddha, meaning the three most important ones, but they're often so changed that they don't hold that same meaning that they did. But so that's the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. Any questions? We'll go around the room. Oh, Ron, good to see you tonight.
Yeah, I try to envision that scene sometimes.
Sitting there.
And to, I don't know if it has any use, to try and see where the other four were coming from, how much that they had already absorbed of this. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've thought about that too. It'd be nice to know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing anywhere that I've come across that references anything except there they were.
Right. Because he speaks pretty easily about the clinging aggregates, which makes me think that was already something that they were familiar with.
I would bet.
He doesn't go anywhere with that. He just says there's five clinging aggregates.
Yeah, now we have to remember this is also what was recorded. It may just be that there was another, a more in depth teaching or maybe something to learn. We just don't know.
Yeah.
But he does cover a lot of it. When you think
it Anand records it this way. He was a stickler for recording what was said.
Yeah.
I assume this was said by one of the four.
You assume what?
I assume that this was said by one of the four.
Oh, yeah, someone recounted it, sure.
He was there.
Yeah. The same with the other one. Well, Ananda might have been there. It said that Ananda was around for the Buddha's life. He only didn't become his second for the last 25 years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
So, it you know, who knows? Ananda might have been hanging around and heard it. But to me, the important thing is the setting and the people, though, that, you know, who these five people are. I mean, they kind of just happened to be there. It wasn't like he sought them out, you know. So
right.
Even that is, but there they are.
Because
so.
He did try to go back to his two teachers.
Yep.
And found that both of them had passed away.
Yep. In close proximity to each other, too. Thank you. Lorna, good to see you tonight.
As always, it's good to be here. Thank you for the teaching. Last week, we just left the hindrances last week, and I took a look at my practice and realised that I was not doing what the Buddha asked in a lot of ways. So I'm going to be trying to be more accepting, just accepting of what the Buddha says, not question it. Not overthink it, not counteract it, not do anything, just accept it, because all that extra thinking that we tend to do just leaves you very frustrated, your practice goes nowhere, you get frustrated with your practice, and which is where I was a little bit at that time. So the teaching on the hindrances last week was very useful for me.
It is an incredibly useful teaching.
Always to be reminded, it creeps in.
And that scenario you described is a very powerful scenario to use to ignore your own ignorance, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
the problem.
Yeah. And then got your newsletter, read your newsletter, and the really important pieces on the newsletter that you referred to tonight is in italics. When I was reading, and the italics of the passages, when I was reading the italics somewhere, I can't remember exactly what I was reading. I've always known that the problem is anatta, how we think of ourselves is the problem, that we have fixed ideas of how, because we have anatta, we have fixed ideas of how life should be. And I think I sort of got the teachings correct in my head. But when I was reading the passages, I saw more clearly that it's me. I can't describe the difference between describing anatta as you describe anatta and the thought that I had when I was reading about it. I really got that it's me. I seem to be splitting hairs, because I understood that it was me anyway, but I sort of got more of a penetrating feel that it's me, that's what I think of me, that's the problem.
Yep.
And I really got that just when I was reading the passages. I think that's all I have to say.
That's pretty profound. The problem is what we think is me, you know, and that it's not really splitting hairs when you finally understand that this thing, this me, is really just an idea, and it's an idea, it's a notion that's developed from a lack of understanding, which means ignorance. And so that's all it is. When you first get that, it's pretty disheartening to even accept it.
Mm.
But when you finally get it, the freedom and liberation is, it can't be touched, it really can't, because you're letting go of everything that is stress inducing, that is false, and you're allowing for reality to settle in. by understanding who you are. So, very good description of it.
Thank you.
Mary, good to see you tonight.
Hi, John. Good to see you. Good to see everyone. I had referenced last week that right before the class I had gotten an email from someone at work, and I was anticipating a difficult conversation the next morning, and I was thinking about hindrances and anatta and anicca, etc. And so, anyway, I really wasn't, it was on my mind because I brought it up, but I wasn't letting it bother me, and I was being somewhat skillful, and I received this email with just one word, and that's what triggered the, this could be a difficult conversation tomorrow. Very difficult. And so I realized there were a couple other people on the email, which then made that word even, there were other people on that email when that word came out. Anyway, I sent a note over saying, hey, do you know, to someone else on the email, and I just said, do you have any idea what the person who sent it found so unacceptable? And that was just skillful, just get a little more clarity and information before I go into this call. And I let it go, and we drove home, and it was fun. And then we get to bed, and I start laughing, and I said to David, I said, it wasn't meant for me, and the word wasn't even meant for me, the word in the email, because the person I reached out to and said, oh, what did he find so unacceptable about me, or whatever my work was, or something. She said, no, it was a reference to something else. It was a joke. It was meant for me or whatever. So I'm sitting there, you know, on my bed just chuckling about, thank God I didn't go over the top. Another time in my life I would have. Yeah. And I just had to laugh about it, but also, obviously, it was funny. And then the call went perfectly fine because I was perfectly competent to do the call. But I had to also recognize that I did remain calm and I did remain skillful, but it was such an example of like, it almost seems silly to repeat the story, but it was a real life thing that happened. And anyway, it garnered some good conversation with us, and it was such a good lesson.
Yeah.
In I made it about me. You know, so
your conditioned thinking had you projecting
right.
something that was
absolutely.
That, and there, none of it was based
right.
in reality.
The
but it seemed real. That's the,
oh,
yeah.
Very well. And it is something I struggle with. My phenomenal life in a corporate environment, I'm often wrestling with, how does this work in this environment, you know? And so anyway, it was really a very, very good lesson. I mean, it was such a strong... it was so strong in so many ways that I've carried it with me. That was what, last Wednesday. And I really carried that with me through quite a few circumstances since then, that, you know, there's nothing here there. There's nothing here. There are things you have to be responsible about. There are things you have to respond to in time. But it shifts the urgency. It shifts the responsibility and accountability. And even the wear and tear that you could create the suffering on yourself because of that. So anyway, it was pretty funny. Oh no, that wasn't meant for you. That was a joke to me, blah, blah, blah. I was just like, I spent an hour of my ride home went, I know it was unacceptable. Yeah, it was pretty funny. So very good lesson and very effacing and certainly a lesson in impermanence and not the hindrances, my hindrances. So, all very good. Shine the light.
All very good, but and the context that you've developed to see it in, and that really is the important thing.
Yeah.
You know? Again, a couple of years ago, it would have been just an experience that you might not even noticed.
Right. It
would have devolved into the two of us unskillfully coming up with how she was going to approach it, and instead it was a within the context of our practice.
Yeah.
Slowing everything down.
Yes.
It prompted me to act skillfully because instead of trying to solve her problem, which is what I normally would do, which is just normal dude stuff.
Well, you are good at it, though.
Persistent.
But it's just a good...
Right. And we took the time to recognize that we didn't do all of those things. Yeah.
But it's such a great lesson, though. It's such
yeah.
a practical lesson.
Yeah,
and that you both see it, and thank you for sharing it. That's how it works.
Yeah.
You know, again, the seemingly mundane, unimportant aspect of life or event became very significant simply because of what you could bring to it.
Right.
Dhamma.
And the power I gave to the person that was saying it.
Yeah.
To, you know.
Thank you for bringing it up. That's
yeah.
how the Sangha works. So.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mary. David, good to see you tonight.
Oh, good job. I think we tagged him enough there.
Thank you. Liz, good to see you. We missed you last week.
Yeah, I've been busy. I had company and an exhibition and some things going on.
Oh.
I'm doing well. My practice is good. I've set an alarm on my phone for 5 o'clock in the evening. And even if I can't sit at that moment, I at least stop for a moment and breathe and sort of become aware of where I am and what I'm doing.
That's great.
So I'm keeping the Dhamma in the forefront.
That's great. Thank you. Good integration of modern technology and right effort. Good for you. Frank, good to see you.
Good to be here tonight. Thanks for teaching this tonight.
My
pleasure. I kind of like this sutta, probably my favorite one,
mm-hmm.
just because it's, I feel, a very personal experience of Siddhartha Gautama's awakening, more so than when he tries to explain that in the Nagara Sutta. I think that this is really, now that I have a basis of, or a greater, a broader understanding of the Four Noble Truths, dependent origination, I can see it's everything, all his teachings, that everything that I've learned so far are all within that one sutta, from dependent origination, the five living aggregates, his, how he seen, how it says in there, like vision arose, knowledge arose, like everything in there just tells me that's like the Eightfold Path. Like that's, he brought the Eightfold Path out of that vision arose, knowledge arose, discernment arose. And that's how I see it. Pretty good.
Yeah, that is pretty good. Thank you. I would suggest when you have some time, read the Nagara Sutta again in reference to this, and then read, when you got a lot of time, the Anapanasati and the Satipatthana Sutta in reference to this now, because you'll see how in both of those suttas, he first starts with, one is teaching breath meditation, the other is using the examples of monks, how they meditate to teach the same thing. Notice how he goes through that progression and then concludes with using this mindfulness, this a well-concentrated mind, to incorporate Four Noble Truths. That both of those suttas end up at that same place. So I would suggest when you got some time to read it in those lights. So thank you.
Right.
Bonnie, good to see you.
Good to see you.
And you could, all of you could do the same.
I just think that keeping the Eightfold Path in mind for me is easier than I have to remember that it's in reference to the Four Noble Truths, and I know that if I don't refer it back to the Four Noble Truths, then it's what they, I think there's something, I don't know if I read it on the newsletter or from last week, but that
either way for me, the Eightfold Path is such a steady constant. It's since ultimately I am this really very emotional being, it keeps the balance because it's so cognitive, because it is so functional and concrete. And by applying that to my living, it has, I think it has simplified things for me. I may not be awakened so simply to say, oh, well, there it is, but it, in applying it and using it has really, it's been, it's relieving.
Yeah,
suffering.
That's the right word, isn't it? Because we're dealing with stress. Thank you, Bonnie. The Cliff Notes version, really, is it, of the Four Noble Truths is always useful. You know, when we're caught in a disappointing or stressful experience, to remind ourselves, dukkha occurs, and that immediately or can immediately depersonalize the situation. It's just what's occurring. It's not happening to me. It's a consequence of having a human life. Dukkha occurs, and if I find myself wanting the situation to be any different than it is, I remind myself of the second noble truth, that it's wanting things to be different that are exacerbating that first thing. Acceptance is the answer, what Lorna talked about. And the third noble truth, to remind myself that this is all impermanent. That's what the third noble truth speaks directly to, impermanence. And that can help me find what factor of the Eightfold Path I need to be most mindful of right now, if it's one or if it's all of them. But as we integrate the Eightfold Path, it becomes automatic, and which is what you're describing. We don't have to go through the whole thing. We just find ourselves in right view, in a mind of peace. Frank.
Yeah, that's a good place to enter. I don't see the path as linear. I see it as a circle, explaining experience of where suffering arises.
Yeah.
You know, for me, that's kind of like how I see it right now. I was looking for a path, and now I find myself in the middle of it.
Yeah, and you're right, it's not linear, you know. At times it might seem that way, but it begins and ends in right view, and so it's circular. Thank you, Frank. Any other questions or comments tonight's? Our retreat is a month from tomorrow, so if you're going and you haven't signed up, sign up and join us. Can't think of anything.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else pressing? We're going to be doing something with Rare and Learning Cooperative. I had a meeting with Mary Beth last week, and she asked what's more important than getting some interior painting is doing a little work outside. So I'm going to go down there next week and scope it out. But they need a sign put in, so someone who's good with art. And it needs some repairs done to a deck outside. So, and hopefully we'll set a date and we can go do that. So, probably after retreat. So let's finish with metta as we always do. So find your relaxed meditation posture. And again, become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, admitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will.
Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.